Hello and welcome to the second Tour de France podcast on humansinvent.com. My name is Richard Moore, the author of Tour de France 100 and Sky's the Limit, and today I'm joined by Daniel Freeb, the author of Mountain High and Eddie Merckx the Cannibal, and also Owen Slot from the Times newspaper. We are on board the Mega Smeralda, this enormous boat that is doubling up as race HQ and press centre. Today we're going to look ahead to the tour, chat about our first impressions of Corsica, about last night's team's presentation. We also have an exclusive interview with Tim Kerrison, the coach to Chris Froome and Bradley Wiggins, who also has a fancy job title with Team Sky, which none of us can remember at the moment. And we're going to talk a little bit about Owen Slot's ride at the start of the week. He has ridden the first three stages of the tour, so he can give us some exclusive insights into the course. And we'll talk a little bit about Lance Armstrong, the ghost who has risen from the dead overnight. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Richard.
And hello, Owen.
Good morning.
Good morning, indeed. Yes, we're less than 24 hours from the start of the tour. We've both been in Corsica for varying lengths of time. Owen, you've been here a little bit longer than Daniel. Can you tell us a little bit about your start of the week here? Because you rode the first three stages of the tour.
Yeah, I got here last Friday, so I've been here exactly a week. I thought the only real way to do your research for an event like this was to ride it.
So I said, you always ride the whole tour before you cover it. Is that something you made a habit of doing?
I have to say that I've tried to in the past. There's been a few tours which I haven't quite completed every stage. In fact, most of them I haven't completed any stage. So it's reasonable that you've picked me up on that.
This is the first time you've ever ridden a stage, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's going well, this podcast.
Is it the first time you've ever ridden a bike?
I had a new bike for this one. I took off the panniers and the satchel from the front.
We've heard a lot about these stages. Now tomorrow's stage is one for Cavendish week, we understand. It's a sprinter's stage. You can perhaps confirm that and tell us a little bit about stages 2 and 3 and just how difficult they are.
Tomorrow's,
how was your sprint at the end of stage 1, for example?
We finished on the seafront in Bastia on some cobbles, actually, and I didn't realise I wasn't prepared for the pavé. It's not my style of riding.
No.
Though seriously, stage one, it is what you see is what you get. There's a few lumpy bits at the beginning, but it is fairly straight and pretty flat for the last sort of 100 miles, basically. So it's going to end up with Cav scrapping for it and probably winning it. Goes on around a beautiful piece of southern coastline. There's a loop at the beginning, which is sort of Corsica basically showing off for the first time, and then all the way up the east coast to Bastia. Bastia's a gorgeous sort of tumble-down, Italianate-looking seaport. I think we'd like to stay there for longer than one night.
And how about stages 2 and 3? Just how difficult are they? Cavendish was saying yesterday that he thought that stage 2 might see quite a big bunch approach the finish and that some of the sprinters will be there, the implication being that he might be one of them.
Well, there's four category climbs in each of them, so there's quite a lot of hard work. I mean, not for me, I didn't find it too challenging. First of all, both stages are absolutely stunning. Stage 3 has this incredible piece of coastline, but it's stage 2 is effectively a long crawl and then three of the categorised climbs all close together. And then there's a long sort of 40k roll in towards Ajaccio. So if the peloton does get splintered over the climbs, which probably will do a little bit, there's plenty of time for a chase to catch up. And then there's this rather nasty little hill at the end, which is 8.9%. So I think that I suspect that will sort a few people out.
So we're probably thinking, for all that Cavendish might hold on Sunday, it could be Cavendish, Sagan, and then somebody like, I don't know, Gilbert at his best, or even Rodriguez or somebody like that. What do you think, Daniel?
You're talking about stage 3
well,
now, Rich?
All three stages.
I mean, personally, I think Cavendish will be there on Sunday, especially on the evidence of last Sunday in the British Championships. I mean, okay, perhaps not quite as hard. There certainly wasn't 1,100 metres to climb in the Glasgow circuit.
It wasn't. Montrose Hill is not quite that.
No, but it was certainly fairly lumpy. And
Montrose Street, I should say.
So I think he'll be there, and everyone's convinced that stage 3 will be quite selective. I'm not entirely convinced. I think it depends on how the race is ridden. Obviously, Christian Prudhomme gave an interesting interview to one of the local papers here the other day and said exactly that. When he took the reins of the Tour de France, he often said in interviews that it was 50-50, riders and course. You know, he laid out the canvas and they sort of painted on that. But now he's convinced that it's 75% the riders and 25% the course is his input. He gave the example of 2011, the Mont des Alouettes, which is where the first stage finished. And before that, he thought that not much would happen. Mm. It wasn't hard enough to break up the race. And actually, it was a great finale. Whereas,
Gilbert was the winner there.
Gilbert was the winner there.
And I think whereas 2008 last year, as well, with Valverde. Do you remember in Brittany?
Yeah, exactly. Whereas last year, Serang was a very difficult uphill finish and not a whole lot happened. It was a fairly straightforward victory for Sagan. So, you know, a lot depends how the race is ridden and whether a team like Sky is really worried about this third stage, really feels that the race could break up and therefore takes control quite early.
It also depends on whether somebody wants to try and ignite the race. I'm thinking the Giro where rider Hesjedal was very aggressive early on, misleadingly so as it turned out, but there could be a rider like that who decides to try and take the initiative early.
I think if stage three was further along in the race, it would be absolutely ideal for that kind of a break. Mm. I mean, it's so up and down, there's no room for anyone to put together a team to chase, or it's very hard to. Mm. But at that stage in the race, so many riders will be trying to keep their powder dry and just last through till where it really happens, sort of in the third week. But there is definitely an opportunity if someone wanted to lay down something early.
And I think the fear factor is greater in the Tour. I think riders are certainly more apprehensive about the rest of the race than they are in the Giro. You gave the example, Rich, of the first stages in the Giro this year, Hesjedal going on the front, and other riders following. You do see riders kind of treating the first week with more trepidation in the Tour, simply because it's harder. I mean, the standard is higher, there are more riders on top form, every team brings their A team, so, you know, it's the sheer physical kind of exertion that they go through every single day on the Tour, which isn't always the same on the Giro.
Now, Daniel, you've not been here quite as long as, what are you're the sort of problematic arrival in Corsica last night.
Yeah, my bags were still in Marseille.
They lingered for a while.
No, they've arrived now. Right. You should have
it
noticed.
Smells too badly.
No,
does it?
You should have noticed that I've changed outfit. I know. I'm still very well coordinated today.
I didn't notice that you changed outfit. Actually.
No, I got here yesterday afternoon fairly belatedly, but yeah.
First time to Corsica.
Yep. Very impressed, actually. Beautiful. Very, very mountainous. More mountainous than I thought.
I've been here all week, lying on the beach, unlike Owen. And it is a beautiful place. I've been up in Ajaccio, which is lovely. Mm. Scene of the finish for stage two. And it is a beautiful island. Yesterday we were here for the press conferences, which is basically just a succession of riders trudging in very reluctantly, sitting in front of hundreds of journalists and TV crews, with very strange sunburns and vacant eyes, and looking thoroughly bored.
You don't think it's the highlight of the build-up?
It's funny because
it's a flawed concept.
Most teams come in en masse, all nine riders, and then none of them are asked any questions. No. Team Sky's press officer last night very forlornly asked if we could consider the other riders and not just address all our questions at Chris Froome, which was slightly unrealistic. Request.
He also staged the only press conference to start notably late, didn't he?
I have to say, Team Sky press conference was once again a shambles. It's just something that in 4 years they've done lots of things very well and some things not very well.
You didn't feel there was a marginal gain there?
No, I don't think so, no. Yeah. Do we learn anything from these events, Owen? Chris Froome spoke about being very confident and super conditioned. Richie Port was quite interesting as well, just talking about riding in support of Froome and
I think we spend a lot of time in those press conferences picking over their words like sort of bones and seeing if we can make anything from them.
And there isn't a lot of meat on the words.
Well, I mean, Chris Froome's never going to come in and say I'm actually in really bad condition.
True, that's true.
I mean, what I think thought one thing was quite interesting yesterday was Cab talking about the roads in Corsica. I think it was specifically a reference to day three, and how they were potentially quite dangerous, which is a reasonable point.
And
I stayed upright, by the way.
Richie Port as well said that when they came and recce'd the stages in March, that they were quite shocked at just how technical they were, he said.
You're listening to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com and Sharp.
Another press conference that we attended yesterday was that of Andy Schleck. Now, Andy Schleck press conferences these days are not what they used to be. There's a sort of poignant air to yesterday's in particular, where Schleck looked ahead at this route and said, if this was 2011, this is a course that I would be looking to win on, but that's not the case anymore. And you think, this is a rider who's only, I think he's still 28. He should be in the prime of his career. Daniel, what do you make of Andy Schleck and his prospects here?
Well, it's interesting, he mentioned that yesterday. He gave sort of 2011 as the line in the sand. I think there's a lot of confusion and mystery surrounding why, exactly Andy Schleck is no longer at the level he was at in 2011, because there was the crash last year in the Dauphiné, but really his level had started to dip. I think we mentioned this in the previous podcast, is that his level had started to dip well before that. Can a crash affect someone's confidence so much? It can obviously affect
confidence and also the physical condition, I guess.
The thing is, the physical condition is the difference, though, isn't it? Mm. I mean, it can affect departments, areas of your riding. I mean, in your long and illustrious career as a Commonwealth Games cyclist, Rich, you might have experienced that in your long and illustrious 3-day career as a Tour de France ghost rider. You might have experienced this loss of confidence.
Well, I have to say, I did fall off my bike about 3 weeks beforehand, and it didn't dent my confidence at all. So I'm not sure what Schleck's playing at here. Seriously, I mean, we sort of beat about the bush with Schleck, really. I mean, we're all sort of wondering if there are darker reasons why he's not riding well.
Controversial.
Oh, well, that's a subtext. We don't know the answer to it. I mean, that's
the question that's always asked these days when someone.
It's the question with anyone who performs well or performs badly.
Someone whose form is as erratic as Andy Schleck's. And as he did point out yesterday, his form has always been erratic. He's often come into the Tour with no wins, as he said, and then produced miracles at the Tour. The other point that Andy Schleck made was about the last Tour in which he was a contender, 2011. Remember, he complained about some of the dangerous descents. He wasn't very happy about them at all, which was probably an error on his part in terms of telling his rivals where he might be weak. But also, he complained quite vociferously, quite strongly yesterday about the Alpe d'Huez descent, which we talked about in the last podcast. It's interesting, there seems to be not a consensus, but certainly a number of riders who feel pretty strongly that it's too dangerous. And that will be interesting to see how that one pans out. It was something that Sky addressed yesterday as well.
I mean, I personally think that we might see a route change there. There are all sorts of other, we talked about the environmentalist issues that to do with that descent in the last podcast. There are all sorts of other threats hanging over this Tour, strikes and floods in the Pyrenees. Christian Prudhomme hinted earlier this week that the route will be the original route, and although he said that quite explicitly, that there will be no changes. I personally think that with the sort of clamour and the complaints about the Alpe d'Huez, the Col de Sarin descent, there could be a change there, and that there is a very easy alternative. A left turn just after Huez.
One other aspect which I think when the route was originally announced was, the fact that we're in Corsica for the first ever time. There's a history of certainly tension between Corsica and France, and there was, I suppose, some suggestion that there might be problems here. I know that the Tour themselves have cold poured water on that prospect, as you would expect. This Grand Départ and the presentation last night and the start tour in Porto Vecchio, it surprised me that it's such a small town. It's not one of the big towns in Corsica, and it was quite a low key event last night.
It's very quiet, isn't it?
Yeah. Very quiet indeed. Yeah, I mean, we walked away from the presentation last night, straight into town, straight into one of the first restaurants that we saw, which is unheard of for the Tour to be able to. At the presentation, to be able to just sort of walk in off the street.
It's usually your barometer of a great team presentation, isn't it? The amount of time between leaving and getting into the restaurant.
Well, that certainly is one of the indicators, traditionally.
It is a small island, but you don't quite get the impression that this is the greatest thing that's ever happened and that everyone is clamouring to
celebrate. What were the crowds like for your 3-day jaunt earlier in the week?
One of the riders that I came with, his parents came out and they stopped every 50 yards and rang a bell and clapped us. So we felt like it was like being in the Tour, I imagine.
Were they in a vehicle or were they on foot to be able to do that?
Let's go back to Andy Steck.
This is the humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast, powered by Sharp.
Welcome back to our Tour de France podcast on humansinvent.com. I am Richard Moore and I'm with Owen Slott from The Times and Daniel Freeb of various outlets. We were just having a little chat there in our little interlude about Mark Cavendish and his new brand identity, suggesting that he has unbranded himself. He launched, for those of you who don't follow these things closely, he launched a new brand at the start of the week, which is basically...
it's vowel free.
Oh no, sorry, not Merck, just the second name. Just he's taken the vowels out of his name. Now I misunderstood. I was lying on a beach in Corsica at the time, so I didn't really follow this all that closely. But I did see a few references on Twitter and other places to a new logo being as, which was the initials FST as FCK. I initially understood that to be the brand identity, and I must admit. I'm no prude, but I was quite shocked at that. I thought, one thing I really admire about Cavendish's judgment in sprint finishes, his decision making is brilliant. It's flawless, faultless. But I think this was, if that was mooted as the Cavendish brand identity or some kind of tagline associated with it, which it was certainly at the launch, I think that was a huge error because. I think it potentially alienates a lot of people. Cavendish is loved, especially by kids.
I mean, it's an interesting issue. I know, Slotter, you've got kids, haven't you? Slotter, you're also the author of an acclaimed children's book. Acclaimed children's books on sport, aren't you?
Were they both acclaimed? I think they were slightly more than acclaimed.
What do we mean by acclaimed?
Acclaimed.
No, they were acclaimed.
In the Slotto household. But
my mum liked them.
But this issue of, you know, Cavendish is obviously someone who does use colourful language in press conferences, etc. Does that detract from his power and his, you know, appeal as a role model to children? Because, you know, obviously that's a huge...
I don't think he's particularly dangerous. I think the kids find him really exciting and if he's a little bit edgy, that makes him more exciting. I mean, this thing sounds to me like, well, hey, what about in the modern era, an athlete who has unbranded themselves? In a day when everyone has to have a brand, he's gone the other way. He's the athlete that's gone unbranded. We like that.
What, up till now, you mean?
Well, he was branded on Monday, and now he's unbranded.
Do many riders launch an official brand? Maybe they do. I'm... Not aware of that, I think.
It's pretty much a first, apart from Live Strong, which was obviously linked to the charity. But.
Yeah.
Well, they tend to launch their own bike now, don't they? Chris Hoy's got a bike.
Yeah, I mean,
Pendleton bike.
Contrasting it with Chris Hoy, I couldn't imagine Chris's as well, but I can't imagine him coming out with that. And, you know, Chris Hoy's market is quite different, I guess. Mark is the bad boy of cycling, I guess, and that seems to be what he's embracing with this. But I do feel that it's a misjudgment if this is... I think it's been dropped from the web. Daniel's research on the website this morning suggests it's...
Well, the tagline has been dropped.
The tagline. And I read an interview this morning with the guys who came up with the brand. And they said that, it's on a website, which I can't remember which one, but I'm going to check that and tell you in the final segment of this podcast. But he... they said that the tagline was purely for the launch event on Monday. Mm. So that might not have any longevity.
I think if you've got on the bike, you are not going to see mothers screaming out to the shops to buy them for their kids.
Well, no, not if they're on the bikes. Is he selling bikes? Is that part of the plan as well?
My understanding is that this brand will carry across several Cavendish and those products, whether they be sunglasses. This is something.
Sunglasses.
this is something that he actually has been talking about since the start of the year, and it was also part of the deal moving away from Sky. Actually,
gave him a little bit more freedom with things like shoes. He could experiment with Specialized, I know, want to use him quite prominently in, on bikes and in, you know, accessories, as a brand ambassador as well.
Now, speaking of Sky, as you were there, Daniel, brilliant segue. I was in Nice last week and I spoke briefly to Tim Kerrison, the coach to Chris Froome and also Bradley Wiggins, about Froome's and the team's prospects for this Tour de France. And we're hoping to speak to Kerrison regularly during the tour about various aspects of his work. And here's my interview with Tim Kerrison from Nice. Are you based here a lot of the time now?
Yeah, I've moved down to this neck of the woods. Mm. I have a few of our riders. We're starting to get a bit of a concentration riders and a few staff down here.
Who are all the riders? I think Geraint Thomas has moved here recently, hasn't he?
Yeah, the two Americans are here, Richie and Chris, and a few of the young British lads, I think Ben Swift, Luke Rowe. Mm. Ian Stannard's looking at moving down here. Mm. So basically everyone needs to live somewhere on the on the continent where there's good roads for training and good climate, and you can't get much better than that.
Have you got the base then? Is that sort of up and running now?
We've got a little house in a little team house, which is has like a double like a big area downstairs where we can store a few vehicles and stores and nutrition supplies and spares and bikes, and a couple of bedrooms upstairs where riders can come in. We've had a few riders come down and stay for a week, train down here.
Yeah.
We're looking at how we're going to staff that. We've got a couple of coaches based down here.
Is that where you do sort of live there when you're here? No, you've got your own place here.
Because
you've always been sort of on the road the last few years, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm still on the road. I've only spent a few days in my new house.
But it's a postal address. And you've been working obviously closely with Chris Froome this year. How's that been? And I remember you saying about Bradley Wiggins when you started working with him that he was very trainable. Is Chris trainable
as
well?
He is actually. He's very easy to work with. He gets it. You know, he really, really he's a smart guy. He understands the training. He understands why we do things the way we do it. He's very, like most of the guys, loves riding his bike. It's never a battle to get him to do the work that's required. If anything, you have to hold him back at times. You know, this year he's been so committed to achieving not just the tour, but you know, we all recognised that we needed to go through a process leading into the tour, which wasn't just getting performances, but it was building the confidence of the guys around him, building a team of guys around him. You know, we've got a fantastic pool of talent to draw from for this year's tour. We all believe in, you know, how couldn't you believe in Chris's ability to deliver this year? He's been so consistently good all year.
I was standing with you on Green Mountain at Tour of Oman. He was racing there against Contador and Rodriguez and the other tour contenders. Was that the first moment you realised that he could step up?
Those early season races are always not necessarily the best form guide, because everyone comes into them from a slightly different background. That was a race that we identified back in December that we wanted to go and do and perform well in, but not necessarily win, because we didn't know it. I hadn't done the race before, Chris hadn't done the race before. We didn't know quite enough about it to know what sort of form everyone else would come into the race with. But it was certainly very encouraging to see Chris start the, on that stage he was second behind Rodriguez, but to start the year that way, being able to climb with the best sort of punchy climbers, because those stages are relatively short, they're relatively sedate for the first 80% of the stage, and then it kicks off in the end. So it is quite a punchy, explosive climb, and for Chris to be able to take on those punchy, explosive climbers was really encouraging early in the season. And then he went on to Tirreno and was good there, but had one off day that put him into second overall.
His season has been remarkably similar, slightly different program, but remarkably similar to Bradley's last year when, you know, he built up this momentum by winning these races. I mean, have you basically just got him doing the same program, or?
I mean, it's the same.
It seems like you have a blueprint that you've established.
It's the same concept, in that we knew that to be as well prepared as possible for the tour, it takes more than just being physically prepared. It means you have to have 9 guys who are physically optimally prepared. So there's as much work, and I'm sure I said this last year as well, but there's as much work gone into the training and preparation of the other 8 guys, whoever they will be, that has gone into Chris. We knew that we had to have guys who believed, who all worked well together, they got on well together, they believed in what we were trying to do, they believed in the leader, we needed to have, in the scenario that you take the yellow jersey relatively early in the race, as we did last year, you need to be accustomed to the extra demands of podium every day and press conference every day and doping control every day. And even if you're not in the yellow jersey, there's still being a big favourite, as Chris is, a hell of a lot of attention from the media and fans. And so Chris has spent a lot of days in the jersey this year, every day in the Romandie, a few days in Tirreno, quite a few days in Dauphiné. So he's very accustomed. You know, he's ready.
What about Bradley? Because I'm sure he's disappointed to miss the tour. Are you still working closely with him? Do you think he can return?
Brad's obviously very disappointed with the way his season has gone. It's been a challenging year for him, and he's really disappointed not to be racing the tour in such a historic edition as the defending champion. He's very determined to turn things around for this season and reset his goals and his focus, and he's working towards that now. So he's been out in Mallorca training last week. He's back in the UK. He came back, got some further treatment on his knee yesterday. He's back out on the bike as we speak. He's out training.
So are you still working quite closely with him?
Yeah.
Can there be room for him and Chris in the team? Because that's obviously the question that we've been asking all year.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are speculating, but the way we see it, we have an extraordinary depth of talent within the team, depth of strength, and we want to be able to put the best team on the road. This year it wasn't possible, unfortunately, although it was always the plan after the Giro for Brad to go through a 3 or 4 week transition period and then come back up for the tour. But unfortunately, it hasn't been possible with the situation with his knee. But we move on, and they're both with us for another year, and we'll put the strongest team we can on the road in the future.
Just final question. I mean, last year Bradley was also the favourite going to the tour. Chris is the favourite this time. Do you feel more confident this time with Chris than last year with Bradley? Do you think?
We're very, very confident. Yeah, there's nothing more that we could have done, but I think we need to be very careful that we're not overconfident. You know, it's easy to think these things are going to come easy, because last year we wanted to win this series of races with Bradley, and we ticked, we achieved every one of them, right up to and including the Tour and the Olympics. This year it's gone exactly the same way with Chris, and I think the whole team needs just to be careful that we don't get too comfortable or complacent, because we know we've got some very, very strong rivals out there who are going to make the race as hard as they possibly can for us, and some strong teams. We need to stay in our game and keep focused and do everything as we do as a team, with as much attention to detail and as we possibly can.
The Tour de France with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Welcome back to this Tour de France podcast on humansinvent.com. It's Richard Moore here with Daniel Freeb and Owen Slott. And a reminder that we're going to be podcasting every day during the tour, that hopefully in quieter places than this boat. And we'll be joined from Tuesday by Lionel Burney and various guests, hopefully of the calibre of Owen Slott, but can't guarantee that. We're hoping also to have a few international guests from other publications. We've already lined up a few. We've lined up a few at this early stage, so we're hoping to bring in some foreign voices. And finally, today we just want to talk, perhaps not for the last time on this tour, about the ghost of tours past, Lance Armstrong, who has risen from the dead overnight and given an interview to Le Monde, in which it's not clear whether he said it is impossible to win the Tour de France without doping, or it was impossible to win the Tour without doping.
What's written?
Well, he says in my era.
Yeah. So I think it has been sort of mistranslated as it is impossible to win the Tour without doping. I suppose it was inevitable that Armstrong would give a major interview on the eve of this tour, that various people would be clamouring for that. Don't know, Owen, did you request an interview with Armstrong on the eve of the tour? You're somebody who's interviewed Armstrong in the past.
Yeah, no, he often comes to me to share his thoughts.
Yeah.
I've requested an interview pretty much once a week or once a month ever since October, really. But
really, nothing. At least you've not had anything, any positive.
No, not in the slice.
Really?
I mean, he's hardly given any. He's
just out of interest.
He's interacting with all sorts of people.
It's funny because people that do interview Armstrong now, there is a sort of backlash even against the, you know, those people who kind of give him a platform, I suppose. I mean, what would have been the purpose of your interview with him? What would you have wanted to speak to him about? Not to be critical, because I can think of lots of things to ask him about. What would your agenda have been?
I think it's just there's still so much to talk about what happened then and what's happened since, and how much he's lied in what he's says he's been truthful about since. You know, he's so it's so hard to believe half of what he's come out with since he gave his confession. I think it's still a it's just still fascinating, and how he lives with himself, and how he, you know, I just love to know what he does day to day. And
He has a cold beer at 5 o'clock every day after playing golf. Yeah. Apparently,
I don't think he's very good at golf either. I think he's mid to high handicapper.
All right.
It was interesting. He talked in that interview about Travis Tiger. Just a very brief allusion to him having destroyed his life. Now, I mean, if I was to speak to Armstrong, I'd be very interested to know exactly, kind of piece by piece, how his life has been destroyed, how it's been tangibly affected. Because, you know, sometimes he gives the impression of being just absolutely fine, like you said, Rich, playing golf. You know,
yeah, he
does
still
like to give that impression that this stuff hasn't really touched him, yeah, and that he's still got what's important to him. But is obviously not true.
He seems very conflicted in seeking sort of almost redemption by reaching out to people. There's almost a desperation just to be noticed at times as well. I notice him engaging with people on Twitter and so on.
On Twitter, he's bizarre.
Yeah.
It's like he haunts the Twitter sphere, and every now and again someone mentions him or discusses him, and he'll just launch in with a little statement saying, by the way, I'm a really good guy after all.
Yeah.
It's strange. He is conflicted, and you know, this is interesting that he blames Travis Tiger for his downfall rather than the fact that he cheated for 7 years to win the tour. I mean, that's, you know, I think that suggests that he's still not moved on, you know, moved towards a real acknowledgement of guilt on his part.
Yeah, and it also suggests that he still, although he talks about having changed and how he wasn't a great person outside of cycling, there is still certainly a personal edge to these conflicts. Whenever any kind of conflict is very he very quickly turns it into something personal. When it happened with Dirk Nowitzki's the basketball player, Jeff Nowitzki. As soon as Jeff Nowitzki, who was the federal agent who started the investigation into Armstrong, was on his trail, and Armstrong immediately turned very personal on him. And it seems that he bears a real kind of private grudge towards Travis Tiger now.
Well, he turned on anyone who tried to smoke him out, basically, throughout that time.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because he also clearly recognises that some people have won redemption and are more forgiven, I guess, even the likes of Ulrich, by presenting themselves or being considered to be sort of caught up in a system and victims in a sense of that system. And Armstrong, there are a few comments he's made on Twitter and so on, which he tries to present himself as being a victim of his time, or the mistakes made by his generation. It doesn't really wash with him, because although he was part of a system and he came up through a system and he maintained that system, he also had a far more influential role within that system, didn't he? It's difficult to accept that he, you know, could ever be regarded as being a victim of the system and of the time in cycling.
Yeah, and he reaps what he sowed in terms of having been a bully. And, you know, one of the big differences between him and Ulrich was that Ulrich has remained throughout this a very kind of likeable guy, and was always seen as a very likeable guy. And, you know, it reminds me a lot of it. It carries a lot of echoes of the Tiger Woods saga second golf reference. Doing well. That, you know, you felt with the Tiger Woods sex scandal that an awful lot of ill feeling had been building up in the media for a number of years, but they weren't able to vent that because, you know, people were sort of massaging their own relationships with him. But as soon as, you know, they did have something to pin on him, then a lot of kind of personal grievance towards Tiger Woods came out from the media. And I think that's not just we're not just talking about the media with Armstrong, we're talking about the fans.
That suggests it's the media with access to grinding trying to get level with him, whereas I don't think that is quite the case for them. I think
that's also one of the reasons why we're not inclined to forgive very quickly with him, because, you know, a lot of
a lot of us personally had experiences where he was very vindictive towards us and vindictive towards the public and the media.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always a mistake for the media as a collective or journalists individually to take that personally. That's not our job. You know, our job is not to judge in a sense. It's we're as you say, he remains a fascinating character, and as journalists, you have almost a duty to carry on reporting the story, I suppose. You know, the story remains interesting. You can't just wipe it out and pretend it didn't happen, pretend Armstrong didn't happen.
So as you suggested, every journalist would have loved to have an interview with Armstrong, but on the eve of this 100th Tour de France.
But I think that, you know...
But if you're Armstrong and you feel that you want to mend a few relationships, build a few bridges and try and help the sport recover, would you not know instinctively that now is the time to keep your head down? If you had some respect for this great event, you know, in inverted commas, then would you he should know he's got the emotional intelligence to understand that actually now's the time just to let him get on with it, and I'm gonna let the tour go on without
if you're Armstrong
a little
bit. Yeah, of course.
No, but if you're the good guy Armstrong, but if you're the Armstrong who wants to be noticed, who wants to be on the picture, then you see your opportunity, and they're going to all be talking about me.
The point, and I think Armstrong will resurface every year at this time for that reason. And
until he's given everyone an interview.
And it's very interesting the platform he chose as well. Le Monde, I mean, famously, it all started in a way with Le Monde in 1999, the famous quote from Armstrong, "You calling me a liar or a cheat, Mr. Le Monde," was that what it was?
Something like that.
But Le Monde was certainly very vocal in their opposition towards Armstrong, and you know, you feel that he's...
The answer, of course, was both.
Yeah, yeah.
You
feel that he's gone with Le Monde this time because, you know, for maximum shock value.
From that point of view, I guess he probably thinks that that's quite clever as well.
Yes, exactly.
Whereas, as you say, Owen, it's not really all that clever. And the thing that doesn't wash, I guess, is this idea that Armstrong is now going to try a la Wouters to be the guy who helps repair the damage and helps to build a new credible cycling. That's the difficult bit to accept.
Does anyone really buy that? I just think
no.
I think every gesture he makes is to rebuild his own life.
Of course, but that is the way that the other, you know, guys with doping pass. That is the way that they have gained re-entry and gained some measure of redemption. So that's the only possible path for him. But it's going to be a difficult path to walk. I think we'll wrap it up there with Armstrong. I think that's quite enough of that. So thank you very much if you listened this far of the second Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com, sponsored by Sharp Europe. Thank you very much, Sharp Europe. We'll be back with a daily podcast from Saturday after Stage 1, where I'll be joined by Daniel and probably not Owen, but
perhaps... No, I've got to go and ride Stages 4 to 6.
Yeah.